Hello. In this episode of Airs for Architecture, I spoke with John Pawson, minimalist and architect, and something of an Instagram phenomenon, about his life, his work, his ethos and practice.
Airs for Architecture, a podcast about architecture, buildings, urban culture and space.
So, what I kind of hoped we could do is just kind of unpack the story of John Pawson in a way, who's become a kind of, I'm sure you're kind of aware, is with 400 and something thousand Instagram followers, a bit of a phenomenon. And my students and students these days, I suppose, they don't really know much about this movement within architecture. It's a word that they chuck around. So I just thought we could perhaps talk a little bit about that, what it means to you, what it is, how it works, and particularly how you do it. How is one a minimalist as a designer?
Well, you're usually born like that. Yes, I mean, from a young age, or certainly from an age when I started traveling on my own, you know, as I went back to school on my own as a, you know, age 12 or whatever it is. I just liked the idea of traveling light. And mum didn't like stuff. So it probably came from her sort of.
And, what do you mean she didn't like stuff?
Well, she, you know, for example, she had one suit for good occasions.
Mm.
You know, dress something to dress up in, and it made it easier for choice. But it was a Chanel suit. It was a sturdy piece of
good quality kit. But you're from Yorkshire. You're from Halifax.
Yes. Yeah. So, yes, I mean, that obviously have an influence. I mean, we're from the West Riding, so the moors outside Halifax were treeless, industrial architecture was all of Yorkstone. I mean, the roof tiles, the walls, the floors were all stone. So it was fairly homogenous. And of course, it was 19th century mostly.
And a lot of vernacular buildings around as well, which sort of certainly features in your book Minimum, your 1996 book Minimum, this idea of the bare wall.
Yes, I've never understood why. I suppose if you have an art gallery, the best way to see art is on the wall, so that might follow at home. But the idea of completely disguising walls with art seems a bit weird to me, but I'm definitely in the minority.
So you were born in Halifax and then you came down to London. How did you get into, because Wikipedia describes you as an autodidact, which is to say someone who is self-taught.
Yes, well, the thing is, I wanted to be an architect, or I wanted to get involved with building, from a very early age. But at school, I mean, I've said this before, but at school, they said you can't do architecture Pawson because you don't do maths.
Yes.
And actually, as a school that I was at, they. Very, very few architects. It wasn't a subject that was sort of talked about particularly. And then my father said, what's the point of being an architect when you can employ one? Which for me was to miss the point, because it's the doing that's so enjoyable. But I mean, I think work is what you can't get somebody else to do, I suppose.
So were you particularly orientated towards the arts in general rather than the structural side of things?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. And at school, the art school, I don't know whether it was deliberate, but it was the furthest away from anywhere. So you had to walk for miles to get to it. So, of course, when you got there, you didn't want to leave, really.
On a big campus.
Yeah, fairly big. Yes, yes, yes. You got your exercise.
And this was in the 60s?
Early 60s.
So there was still that sort of level of, I mean, I don't wish to impugn art departments now, but there must have been a level of craft associated with that, with the production of art at that time.
There was a very enlightened head of the art school, a teacher, Gordon. What was his name? Gosh. Anyway, he actually died recently, and he was very well thought of, and I think he did encourage, and he was fairly talented. So, it was quite a sophisticated setup. But of course, it wasn't really supported by the, I mean, it wasn't a subject that you got credited for. It was a more of a in the hobby department, I think.
Yes, that's the British way. Try not to pay people who make things with their hands. That's the ultimate goal. So after A levels, what did you do?
Well, I spectacularly didn't get A levels. I sat in the I sat them, and I realized it wasn't going very well, and so left the exam room early, which of course was noticed. But it was a big room full of people trying their best, and I sort of gave up. But strangely, they did give me another two O levels. So I sat two A levels and got O level passes in French and Spanish. I'm not sure if it helps having two French O levels. It doesn't make an A level.
It certainly doesn't. And what did you do? I mean, your parents must have been aghast, but what did you do after that?
They weren't. I mean, in the back of Dad's mind was that I went into the family business, which was making women's clothes and textiles. And my mother was keen for me to do something completely different, like be a missionary in Africa. Something very modest. I mean, at least for the first half of my life, I think.
But you didn't.
I didn't do either. I just set off on the. I mean, it was 66, so it was sort of just before the hippie movement, and but still, friends and various other people were traveling, and the idea was to go overland to India and Afghanistan and things.
And did you?
Yes.
On train.
No, hitchhiking, and then overland anyway.
Must have been extraordinary. To
Um,
Afghanistan in the 60s.
hmm?
To Afghanistan in the 60s.
Yes, and I was 17, but because you think, you doesn't, and I was amazed. Actually, I'm more impressed with my parents than myself, because they sent me on my way. Without any sort of break, it was fantastic. I think I'd be more worried than, I mean, I'm sure they were worried, but anyway, they were positive.
Well, great parents.
I did write religiously all the time, so that my mother kept all the letters. I've got my own letters back. Not as interesting to me, but
And what were you like? Have you read them?
I haven't really read them. I sort of dipped in a bit and thought, oh, well, I've got other things to do.
Yes, but you ended up in Japan. Is it at that point that you found your way to Japan?
It's two separate things.
I
Um,
see.
uh, I went. So I left school, as I said, at 17, and then spent a year and a half traveling. And when I got back, Dad sent a telegram saying, it's about time you came back, otherwise there won't be a place in the family business. So I went back, and went into the family business for actually 6 years. That was in Halifax and in Washington County, Durham.
And this is a mill or an actual fashion?
A factory making clothes. And machinists. And I was put through, each department. So I learned to cut a pattern and then cut out the fabric to make a dress and then machine it and then press it and so on. So I went through the whole process. I did one for my mother. It wasn't quite her style, but I made a bad job of sewing the shoulder, sewing the seam, sewing the shoulder, the sleeve into the shoulder.
Do you still sew? Do you still make with your hands like that?
No. It was a one-off thing, but I did learn. But also, there weren't many men around, so they did warn me not to walk through the machine room at Christmas. Otherwise,
the mind boggles. I'm not going to ask what that means, but I'll just let it go. So after 6 years in that, this is into the early 70s by this point, almost the mid 70s by this point. You signed up for a course at the AA? Is that right?
No, it's a bit more. No, I things weren't working well for me at the factory. By then, I was running a subsidiary company, and I had my own design department. But in the end, it wasn't working, and also I was going to get married, and that wasn't working. So it was all looking a bit gloomy. So I thought I'd escape. And I saw this program about the Zen Buddhist monastery in Japan called Eheiji, and I thought, oh, that's the answer. I'll become a Zen Buddhist monk. I mean, I was 24, but I might as well have been 12. I mean, I was so naive. Anyway, I turned up in Japan and went to this escaped and went to this monastery and. In the new year. I mean, I arrived in Nagoya in Christmas Eve. And so that's how I got to Japan.
Must have been punishingly cold.
Yes, but they have you scrubbing the floors and various other things. But I didn't last. And they gave you some hot water to drink. But yeah, it was a bit of a schoolboy. Anyway, then I spent 4 years in Japan. Then I came back. 4 or 5 years in Japan. Then I came back and finally enrolled at the AA to try and study.
In your late 20s, early 30s?
Yeah, I was like, I think 29 by then.
And you went in at what level? Did you go into an undergraduate, equivalent undergraduate?
No, I went in, I think, probably at whatever they call that. Yeah, when you orientate yourself or something, and it's a sort of catch-all for people who try to work out what they're going to do. I think.
I see.
But I mean, I mean, you know, I got a grant from Maidenhead, funnily enough, from the Council of Maidenhead. I got a grant from them to study at the AA. And so it was really just hanging out at the AA. I paid for 3 years, but I never got a qualification.
This is rather remarkable. And who do you recall?
Seemed normal at the time, sorry.
What's that?
Seemed normal at the time.
Yeah, well, I think that you know, that relationship to education, higher education particularly, is, yeah, that I guess it was with grants and lower costs of living and lower costs associated. I guess that was a reasonably legitimate thing to do. different relationship to education in general, wasn't it? I mean, my students come out of part two now with £100,000 worth of debt. You have to finish at that point.
Yeah. Yes. No, it was it was very different. Yeah, because I hand out the pay slips at the office, and I'm always slightly depressed by the, you know, the column which is student loan.
Yeah.
Which, you know, I mean, it's some of them are more than 10 years.
Oh, I finished paying mine off last month, and I'm in my mid-40s.
Congratulations.
Did it
not.
All... It's amazing. But it's a 9% tax. It's a 9% tax, which is on top of your other taxes, which is quite a lot. So that will be very nice. But so after the AA, did you set up a practice, a design practice?
Well, it doesn't sort of work in a linear way, does it, really? I mean, I've always sort of followed the river, and you know, I went to the AA because I was recommended to go there, and I survived for 3 years, and I was beginning to get sort of the odd project to do, but I never saw it as being in anything formal. I mean, I helped. I felt inspired to redo my girlfriend's flat, which she sort of agreed to, but the landlord didn't, of course. So we were thrown out eventually. So sort of bits and bits, and I always had this sort of phobia about files. I thought if you had files, you couldn't be creative. So I never kept any paperwork at the beginning, which, of course, then it was pointed out to me that there's a legal requirement.
But there is that sense, I mean, looking through the books that have been written about you, and, you know, the various publications you've made yourself, there is this sort of sense that the John Pawson that we know sort of emerged almost out of nowhere, and particularly in relation to the architectural scene in the 80s and 90s, where there was your work was very different to what was going on, generally speaking. I mean, is that because you threw away all the drawings, or was there a sort of turning point where your practice, your design vision, your design aesthetic, I suppose, suddenly became currency?
Well, the thing is, when you're doing it yourself, you're not really looking around. You're just getting on with what you do, and you don't see it in context. And that is slightly true still. You know, you keep your head down and get on with it, and then when you look up, eventually you've done something. But I'm always amazed now, occasionally, or well, certainly with you know, the internet and or the computer, and looking through things, and something called Pinterest, I think. You know, you're suddenly offered pages of work that you think is yours, and then you realize it's not. It's like, and also very good stuff, and actually the often you know, it's better than mine. And I just didn't, you know, when I started, everybody thought I was mad, literally, and my sisters, and there were all sorts of jokes, and people didn't know where it had come from, and you know, nobody else was doing it, and then journalists tried to make a movement, so they sort of banded together anybody who was doing anything modern, which is not the same thing, and
Do you mean modern in the sort of high modernist, the kind of austere?
Yes. So they said that's minimal, or they said, but then of course that word, was very attractive to people because they could apply it to anything really. So it seemed to catch.
How have you found, I mean, yeah, people like Louis Barragan, I've heard your name associated with.
Well, that's very flattering.
Well, maybe it's flattering for him too.
Ask him when
I haven't had him on the
I
podcast,
get to heaven.
but I will. Yes, exactly.
If I do.
Well, I think you, I mean, we can get to the church bit in a bit. But how did your practice grow? Because it doesn't strike me, you the type of client that you seem to have had, certainly the ones that are in the publications, don't seem to be the sort of people who would sort of be looking through the Reba catalogue. Not that you would be in that, obviously, but so it's been a word of mouth thing, or people have seen your work in magazines. I mean, how has it worked?
It's difficult to answer some of these questions because it's not something that I know about. I mean, I know that when I was working with Crispin, who taught me at the AA,
Crispin.
Crispin Osborne, who sadly isn't alive anymore, when Crispin and I, he used to say, "And how do you get these jobs? Where do they come from?" I said, "I've no idea, Crispin, but I meet people at parties, or I meet people out there." I'd mentioned parties, so of course, the next day he came in late, and I said, "Oh, well, how are you?" And he said, "Oh, I went to a party last night, but it's."
Did he get any work from it, or just the
Just got the hangover.
hangover? I mean, how is as a sort of self-directed architect? Obviously, you have no kind of formal credentials in the traditional architecture profession sense. How has your relationship been to the profession? Have you found yourself incorporated, embraced by the AIA or the
Well,
RIB?
it's the thing is that the more of a profile you get, I imagine, the more you're exposed, the fact that you're not qualified. So there is always somebody out there. It may be the same person, this sort of pedant who keeps pointing out, that I'm not qualified. But I find that a bit strange because, I've been doing it for 40 years. And of course, I had to start somewhere, but the education in inverted commas that I've had in terms of actually building so much and being involved so much, it's probably the same thing on paper that the curriculum, for school. And I mean, I did, I hung around for 3 years. I mean, I didn't pass any of the exams, but I mean, I got the education. And the biggest thing I learned, or the biggest thing that I was given really by studying, was that I didn't realize that you could learn to design. I thought it was something inherent in some people. But actually, John Andrews, who was my other tutor at the AA, he, the English John Andrews, he taught me to design. If that's what I'm doing, by the
I think it might be. I think it might be. What I mean, your work is obviously, you're a minimalist architect. Everybody knows John Porson as a minimalist architect. But what is minimalism to you?
I've never shied away from accepting that moniker, but it is very confusing, I think, because it means so many things to so many people. And I mean, if you talk about clarity or simplicity or essence or in any of those, you know, good qualities, then I think that's that you know, that if you can apply that, then that's fine. But the work is highly complex, you know, and it's not, the spaces are controlled in the sense that, you know, hopefully there's no more than you need in them, but sometimes there is, and there is color, there are things, you know, so it's not, it isn't sort of, you know, white walls and concrete floor and no skirting. I mean, that's not what it's about. It's just trying to get to the essence of things.
The essence of things or materials or space.
I think space when you walk into, you know, when you walk into somewhere and you feel good and you're not quite sure what's going on, but it just feels exhilarating, the actual space, regardless of size, then I think you're getting somewhere.
Mm.
I mean, you watch people when they arrive, you know, for example, here at home. I mean, obviously some people aren't aware of their surroundings, but the people who have some sensitivity, they you can see them, you know, there's an exhalation of air and they, you know, they feel good and they walk around sort of slightly exhilarated, well hoped. I mean, they do, and so that's gratifying.
And is there, in that discernment of space, you obviously have designed many different types of buildings for many different uses, churches, monasteries, shops, houses, commercial work. Is there a sense that what you're trying to find the essence of is inherent to that use or function? Or is it space as a kind of abstract but absolute thing?
I think both, really. I think the latter, but on the other hand, you know, they're all, you know, they're all, you know, each one has its own particular sort of function. I mean, as you said, we'll get on to it, but, you know, if you're designing a church, you hope at the end, by the time they get to use it, that it becomes a sacred space. The tools you have to make that space are the same if it's a shop or a church. And that, interestingly, was always a problem for people because they couldn't see, you know, they saw the commercial side of a selling clothes or selling things in a shop as being different from being close to God, you know, in a church. But you need an architect for both.
Mm.
And funnily enough, the monks saw the Calvin Klein shop and the proportions, and they thought, you know, they saw the table, and they thought, oh, well, that would make a good church and altar. And they could see it. It didn't, the fact that, you know, Calvin Klein was selling a different sort of lifestyle, wasn't at all a problem for them. I mean, they were very pragmatic.
Yeah.
But I think people saw that correlation between, you know, sexy underwear and the monks as being so incongruous.
Well, how little they know.
No sex, but they can have underwear.
They can have some underwear. Calvin Klein's Hessian range. Yeah. But do you think that Calvin Klein project you've mentioned, that was the breakout project? Do you think that there was something in your background within fashion and clothes making that made you I'm trying to. I suppose I'm trying to create a fairly clumsy connection here. I think if one were to write a novel called John Porson, the fact that you started in the world of cloth in Halifax and you ended up getting your breakout commission for a clothing manufacturer, a clothing fashion house, I think that would be a fairly straightforward kind of connection.
Yes, I don't think, I mean, Calvin had no idea, about my background. He was given a book by Ian Schrager, the hotelier, and suggested if he was looking for a young, architect, to help him with the store, his first store. It might be somewhere to look.
But do you think that idea of structuring fabric and structuring clothing has actually become this idea of, I suppose, two-dimensional planes and the way that two-dimensional planes connect to create,
Oh,
obviously,
yeah.
clothing?
I mean, the 6 years in the business, in my dad's business, and in the business generally. Was a help. I mean, you wouldn't recommend somebody to do that if they wanted to become an architect normally. But my father was a, I mean, it was he, you know that it had been in the family business for a bit, a few generations. But Dad, one of his strengths, well, I think you had to have it anyway, was he understood material and fabric and textiles, so he could tell the weight of a cloth and the composition of a cloth by just feeling it. And he understood manufacturing, putting things together, and lots of things which, aren't conventionally thought of as helping, but gives you a richer background, I think.
Do you think that is that an important part of your own practice as a designer, as an architect, is this to achieve the minimal aesthetic, you've got to have a very good working knowledge of how things are put together so that you can achieve that kind of refined and precise.
Well, yeah, somebody needs to know that. Doesn't have to be me.
But I mean, do you understand? Is that part of your
I think I do, but I don't. I mean, the other guys around me are conventional architects in the sense they're all qualified conventionally. They're all Part Three, or the equivalent in their country, and I, and that they're all there because of their intelligence and their abilities, not because they're minimal. They're not minimal. There's the odd true believer in the office, but they're, I want them because they're very good architects. That's the main thing.
So I guess what I'm trying to get at is how often when we're teaching architecture, we talk about the detail or we talk about the construction, and that's becoming more and more prevalent in relation to conversations around ecological sustainability and material selection and its impact on environmental concerns and all of that stuff. And even when I was studying there was they talked about it as bioclimatic design and buildability and stuff like that. So there was this idea that knowing how stuff is put together is the first step in knowing how to design things. And, there's a kind of primitivist idea there that a good architect is also a good builder and so on and so forth. But that's not how you design. How do you go about developing a space? I mean, if you're not preeminently concerned about the structuring, the material structuring of a space.
Oh, well, I am, but I'm just not. I mean, I'm not an expert in any of these areas particularly. I mean, I don't have. Yeah, I mean, I'm not. You know, for example, you know, my background isn't in masonry and putting stones together, you know, in a sort of Mesian way. I mean, I'm not, but I sort of have an instinct for what I want. And then, you know, have an instinct for who can help me, you know, get it together, really.
Yeah. Build a good team.
I think so. I mean, you know, we have occasional people leave, but it's very rare.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, there are 10 of us who've been there more than 20 years. I know that because there's when you've been in a company for 20 years, you get a tax-free £1,000 present. But it can't be money.
Really?
You have to have a carriage clock or something.
Is that why? Well,
I'm rather upset that because I keep telling these guys, and I think only one of them has actually said what he's wanted. This is like 2 or 3 years ago. So, I mean, I have to spend it, but they get it tax free.
I see. It's a strange. So the tax code is so weird. Do you think that your minimalism was a reactionary thing? I mean, don't mean reactionary in the negative sense, but was it a reaction against what you were seeing emerging in the 80s and 90s as a kind of essentially like high-tech Baroque, essentially, and the
I don't abundance. Think so, because I wasn't, you know, I wasn't terribly aware of other trends. I mean, I know that the AA, the whole point about being at school is that you are. And certainly, I mean, I was there with Zaha Hadid, even though she's actually younger than me, but she was teaching and I was a student. But I mean, she lived next door actually in Kensington. So occasionally I'd get a lift in with her, because she wouldn't go on public transport, obviously. So I got a lift in the taxi, but had its moments.
How do you see your work in relation to someone like Zaha Hadid? I mean, you're not. Is there a commonality? Is your work part of? Do you see your work as being part of an epoch, a kind of movement?
No, I don't. But and also and any. I mean, you could say it's a bit naive, or you should be more aware of your surroundings, or aware of what's going on. But I haven't really ever sort of had an antenna for things that, you know, being able to put myself in any sort of bracket. I mean, all I know is that when I began, there was no one else. And now there are hundreds of people doing really good things.
Yeah.
It's sort of, I mean, clearly, and you kind of wonder which is better. Is it better to be the only person doing it but have very little work, or is it better to have a lot of work and a lot of competition?
Do you feel constrained by these disciples? Do you feel like you've got, you know, if you wanted to suddenly come out all, I don't know, squiggly or weird shaped, do you think it would be hard for John Pawson to do something else?
Well, I think this. No, I don't feel constrained at all. But I think because you're just trying to do the best you can in whatever medium or whatever area, and there's still a lot to, you know, to do. It's sort of different in terms of, you know, whether you're designing either the stuff, you know, a fork or a saucepan or something, or you're designing a building or you know, the ballet or the bridge or something. There's, you know, there's so many different things you can people that turn up. I mean, I've never felt like doing anything different, really.
Yeah. When you start off with a project, say you're designing a fork or a chair, do you spend time? It sounds, I don't want to make you sound like some kind of, well, Zen Buddhist monk, I suppose, but do you spend time thinking about what it is that that thing is and try
Oh,
and work towards that?
yes, definitely. I think a chair is probably not, I mean, a chair is a really difficult example because it's, you know, it is the, I mean, so many, well, not so many, but some chairs have reached the point where they're sort of perfect. So, and they do everything a chair should do, you know, like the Hansveen chair. The white chair, you know, it's strong, comfortable, elegant. People look good in it, looks good in the space, changes the space you put it in, et cetera, et cetera. So if you're designing a chair, you can maybe get near to something like that. So you can tick most of those boxes. But in the end, it's still a chair that's recognizable. So you're not creating something completely different or new. And I think that's fine. I mean, I don't think you have to. I mean, the thing I found with architecture and interiors and the connection with the two is that however good a chair is, like Mises furniture or Mies van der Rohe's furniture or Hansveen's chairs, is that they do, you know, they're recognizable. So your perception of the space that they're in changes. So if they're overused in any given period, you know, in the 50s or currently, they're too recognizable. So it's quite handy to design a chair that you know, we've designed a chair that I can put in for a bit our interiors and not, you know, not set out that charge where you suddenly see the Hansveen chair and think, oh, you know, all the Vola tap. I mean, very difficult to beat Vola as a design. You know, you can't really get it more elegant and simple. You know, but we've designed some taps because, you know, when you walk into the bathroom and you see that, that's you it's too recognizable.
Sort of carries too much noise.
Yes.
That's interesting. That's a very, very interesting idea. In terms of quite interested. So to me, there seems to be something in your work around the idea of Platonic forms, this idea that spaces have a certain natural character, inherent character, that you try and discern and reproduce in built spatial form. And I'm thinking here about the church that you designed. Extremely beautiful, and the various churches that you've worked on over the years. But of course, it's the Moritzkirche in Augsburg in Germany, which perhaps is your most famous sacred space, which seems to me to be about, much like Rudolf Schwarz's work, trying to get to the absolute heart of what a sacred space is, using light, form, mass, volume, height. I mean, is there a kind of idea at play in your work that there is that there are, kind of true forms to which we pertain as designers? Or is it more to do with an aesthetic idea? I mean, because you talk about it, and I've heard people reference in relation to your work, Donald Judd's work, obviously, and you have, I see on your bookshelf right beside you, a Donald Judd book. Is this kind of where you're trying to get to, kind of essentialize this, get to the heart of what a thing is?
Well, there's sort of two areas. I mean, church in Augsburg, St. Moritz Church, you know, is an existing church that was rebuilt after the British destroyed it, you know, at the end of the war. And it was a very ornate Baroque church. I mean, very beautiful. So the proportions, in a sense, are there. But how you play it and how you play the positioning of the altar and you know, how far forward you bring it or back and the needs of the congregation and things like that. You know, there's clearly a lot goes in, but I think that the actual physical proportions, you know, you get a lead.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the Cistercian Trappist monastery in the Czech Republic, Nový Dvůr, that church was from scratch, although it's formed part of a courtyard. So there were some pointers, but that was pure form, and you know, we made lots of models and tried to get the proportion just right for the monks, for you know, for their 8 daily services. I mean, there are like 40 of them, and you know, there is a room for visitors, but it's a rare thing.
Mm.
But that's a complete new build. So every proportion was, you know, was worked out by us as what we thought might work acoustically and visually, and the proportions and the way light came in. And, but you know, all these things depend a lot on the, you know, on the guys using them. I mean, as your clients, to get Cistercian Trappist monks, I mean, they are the, you know, the dogs monks or whatever. I mean, they're, you know, they wear white and, you know, and they're precise and you know, and they chant beautifully and, you know, and they're, you know, and because they use the church 8 times a day, and that means 16 processions, and you know, it's you know, I mean, it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And you know, Augsburg Church is the, you know, is the parish church, you know, for the people of Augsburg. So that's used daily. People wander in and out to pray, and it's very much a center for the community. So in that sense, all the churches we're doing are used and used a lot. And it's an interesting contrast, because the village we are in here, the church is originally Norman, so it's 1180 or something. I mean, there's only the doorway and an arch left of the Norman period, but it's successively been added to, and they have 4 services a year.
Yeah,
and it needs a bit of repair, and of course, you know, because I live here, you know, one gets involved. So funny that we're going to have to do all this work for a church that gets very little use, apart from physically, it's an extraordinary piece of architecture in the middle of the village.
Yes.
Haven't quite got my head around, because on the one hand, the nicest way to use churches is for their original use. The church we did in, I keep digressing, but the church we did in Hackney, the St. John's Church Hackney, which is of course Anglican, that's used every day, all day, but only on Sundays really for religious purposes. I mean, they have rock concerts on Friday and Saturday, and unmarried mothers during the week. Charitable
It's
things.
much more like churches. I mean, your church built in the medieval period would certainly have had much more of a function similar to that than to a place for just worship. If you read some of the literature around the anxieties of the Protestant reformers at the Reformation about the casual way churches were being used, disgusted them. They wanted something much more serious. So I think that's I think it's really interesting. Does an effective use of a John Porson building require Trappist-like liturgy? Does one's behavior in a minimalist environment need to be in some way inflected by the space itself? You can't be messy, can't be a slob, can't be a scruffy teenager, can't be like me, a kind of mess. You have to kind of curate your behavior. Is it necessary? Is your architecture effective, demanding in this kind of way?
Yeah, I think you do. It does need a certain degree of discipline. Yeah, I think otherwise you. It's I wasn't aware of that. Or I didn't really think about it too strongly. But you can negate the spaces. But you can, very occasionally, or not. I don't know. I mean, but occasionally I get back into places that I've done or invited around, and they've filled the walls with stuff and the floor, and it is unrecognizable, and they don't, of course, they don't see it. They say, look, the house is still here, or the building's still here, and that's fine. I mean, they're not and there's only so much you can do. You can design the building and the interior and kit it out and as far as the client wants. But then you're not there to police it all.
You're not a copper, no. It's a very interesting thought, though, that the work itself is, in that description, perhaps more closely aligned to art, that your work is preeminently an aesthetic practice that is three-dimensionally spatial. Is that missing the mark? Or is it both things at the same time?
I've never equated it to art, but I mean, it is an art, I suppose, architecture. But, it's just to go back. It's like this church in the village is all these different periods put together, but it's still magnificent, or not magnificent, but it's still very handsome in its bits. But some of the stuff inside, where they, if you store the cream tea chairs and tables, and then you negate the space of the church, however strong it is. I think, I mean, you can edit in your head, but you have to keep, you know, you have to have some discipline with the interior. You're all behind the exterior, and if you start sticking on stuff on the outside of the building, or you know, or you do a new roof, which is shiny tin, you can affect the one's perception of the church.
What is the key thing that inspired you as a designer? Who is the designer? What is the music? What is the literature? Do you have any sense of the associations between your work and a broader kind of aesthetic? Is it Bach cello concertos, or is it Miles Davis, or is it
Bach will be up there, yes, but I can't directly attribute anything to him. but you know, Mies van der Rohe's work certainly is, he's the one. I mean, he's the architect. I mean, it's just sublime. I mean, the work, and you know, when you see Farnsworth for the first time, and you're allowed, you know, a bit of space, and there aren't anybody there, it's, you know, for a bit, it's fantastic.
Is it?
And also, obviously, the Barcelona pavilions, you know, but all the other buildings, and Crown Hall, and discovering the, you know, the detailing. You know, which is, you know, when you see it in photographs, of course, afterwards, and you realise, but it's, you know, actually seeing it in the flesh,
yeah,
rails and things lining up,
yeah,
exquisitely, it just exquisitely worked out, and the joints in the stone floor, and then later on, you know, discovering Shiro Kuramata's work, and that was a revelation. And then getting to meet him and being taken under his wing a bit in Tokyo.
This was in those years.
In the 70s, yeah.
Mm.
The 70s, and obviously Mies was early as well, earlier than that. But I mean, you know, I mean, there's a catalogue of people that are, you know, sensational artists.
Yeah.
You know, Brancusch, or obviously Judd. You know, Judd on so many levels, having the exposure to, you know, to Martha early on, and also to his. I mean, I first noticed his work in the early 70s in Tokyo, because a gallery had an exhibition, I think in 75 or something. They had a show of his work. And then Kuramata, of course, was influenced by him as well. So I was picking up on that. And it's amazing when you find somebody who's sort of has such a large body of work that you didn't know, and then you get a chance, you know, to see it all.
Yes. And he mentored you.
Mentally, yes.
How does
I only met Judd like a couple of times with Hester, who was my girlfriend, that she was his dealer in Europe for furniture. So one time I didn't say a word, and he didn't say a word. And then one time we were in Basel, and we were going to go out for lunch, and unfortunately somebody bumped into us and tagged along, so I didn't get a word out of him then either. So, I mean, he wasn't a big talker.
That hardly surprises me.
Yeah.
Just one last question, if I may.
Mm-hmm.
Does the minimalist approach that you embody, I think it would be fair to say, I read yesterday that you're the most important minimalist architect in the world. So, how does the Pawsonite minimalist approach scale up? Does it scale up? Or is it always about the individual object?
I think it's about the individual object. I think you know, every project is approached, you know, from scratch.
Yeah.
I mean, you quickly, of course, fall into, you know, using your experience and things that have happened to you, to
Yeah.
design. But it doesn't really matter what scale it is, I don't think. You know, I mean, I mean, I said it before, but the saucepans, for example, took forever to design, and I mean, they're nice in the sense that you can hold them, you can work on them until you're really happy, because you can see what you're going to get, but they're highly complicated. Which people don't, I don't think, really understand these small things. And then, of course, when you're working on a much bigger scale, you have less control, and you have less control of people because you need so many people. But I think it's still possible to hold on to the essence of you know, what you wanted. You just have to let go of it, which was always a problem for me, letting go. But it's something you had to learn well, especially actually with Calvin Klein, because he is a designer. So you have that. It's often more difficult, you know, because we. You know, because of course, design is always about choice and making the choices. And a lot of the time, you know, it's instinctive for me, and I make the choices. And of course, sometimes you have to justify them and everything else. But with Calvin, he would make different choices. So then, and but you know, I was there to, you know, to make something happen that he wanted, you know, design-wise, that he wanted, or that he was designing, and I was making it happen.
Spatializing it.
Yeah, still slightly different.
Have you found your authorship has been given greater leeway in as of I mean, I assume as you've become more well known and more established, I assume people approach you because they want what you give rather than.
You would think so, well, the age has changed, obviously. I was in my 30s with Calvin, at the beginning, or late 30s, and so the clients were older, but for now, but it doesn't none of that changes, you know, is some clients are, you know, quite willful, or, you know, headstrong, or want to do it themselves, and you know, and the and You know, and I mean, I've always like, I mean, you know, I've liked, I like to listen, because I think otherwise you miss learning. But, you know, and I state my case, and present it, and then if I'm not sort of winning, then I give in, or not give in, but I mean, we go with, what the client wants. And then, of course, the problem is that when it's built, there's nothing you can do. And then when the client realizes they were wrong, you're stuck. So you're not going to be, I mean, they realize, but they don't necessarily thank you, of course, for, in fact, they blame you.
Mm-hmm.
But that's, that's building, that's architecture.
Yeah, for sure. A negotiated process. Would you advocate being a minimalist to young designers setting out? Is it nice being a minimalist?
I think it's very rational, and I think it's trying to find the essence of anything seems the right thing to do.
Mm.
As I said, it's not a hair shirt thing. It's not painting everything white. It's just trying to have exactly what you need, and get to a state where you can't add or subtract without sort of spoiling it. It's just the ultimate, the essence.
Like a haiku.
Indeed, never been very good at those.
Well, John, thank you so very much for taking the time to talk to me. I've really very, very much enjoyed hearing you talk.
I hope it looks all right on paper.
The rest is silence, or at least perhaps it should be. Thank you to John for the privilege of the chat, which was a delight. John's friend, Dejan Sujic, wrote a book on him last year, John Pawson, Making Life Simpler, published by Fiden. There are many others, so have a dig around. Links to John's social and professional profiles are in the podcast description. Thanks for listening.